accumulate, so we'll return the proposals and some comments and do some organizational work. I brought in today Rabbi Wein's book, which I've deliberately not been reading for this class because I don't want to do it my way and not his way. I read parts of it in the past. But there's one topic that I really know very little about the facts of, I mean, the names and the places and things. But I think I know a great deal about the impact of, and that's reform movement. And just remembering that the history course, we have to at least acknowledge the existence of this movement and mention the names of some of the leaders, etc. He has a chapter 6 in his book, which he calls, interestingly, Wein has a great sense of humor, and it pervades the book, but he has a very tongue-in-cheek sense of humor. You don't always see it. The title is Reform Sweeps All, almost, the title of the chapter. I think it's a very good title because at the time period that we're going to look at today, it's again the beginning decades of the 19th century, the early 1800s. So reform does sweep almost everything. We spoke here in this class quite a bit about the Enlightenment and about its effect on general history and its effect upon traditional Judaism. Rabbi Wein points out that the Enlightenment left the Jews with what they saw really as two options. They didn't see a whole other area of options, which we'll talk about too. But there were two options, especially to a Jew who was really interested in engaging in the Enlightenment, who really felt that the Enlightenment had something to offer him. It offered him political freedom. It offered him a chance for an education. It offered him a chance for financial improvement. The Enlightenment offered a lot. So most Jews of the late 1700s, and more so as we move into the 1800s, wanted to take advantage of the Enlightenment. And as I want to put it, there's two options open. One was apostasy, becoming a goy. Either formally, we mentioned a little bit about some of Mendelssohn's children and grandchildren who became converted to Christianity. Either doing it formally and converting, or if not formally converting, pretty much giving up Yahadus and living and acting and behaving like a goy. Not necessarily becoming a full-fledged Christian, but really becoming, for all effects, assimilated. And this is one option. He points out European history is full of such Jews who took that option. Just to mention some famous historical names, Disraeli, who was a prime minister of England during the 1800s, was one such Jew. Heinrich Heine, Disraeli is V-I-S-R-A-E-L-I. Heinrich Heine, H-E-I-N-E, was the major figure of German literature in the 19th century. He was a Jew by birth. Karl Marx, of course, is a Jew by birth, and then many others. He points out, Rabbi Wein, it's a very good point, that one of the things that happens to a person when he becomes a mumar is that he feels guilty, that he abandoned his people. And one of the ways that people deal with guilt is to strike out even more. And many of these people not only turned away from Yahadus in their personal lives, but became anti-Semites, which is so fascinating. He feels that Disraeli was the most moderate of these Mormon. Disraeli writes, "I look upon the church as the only Jewish institution remaining. The Jews owe everything to the church. His father converted to Christianity, and his father said, that wrote, the Talmud was a complete system of the barbarous learning of the Jews. The Jews have no men of genius or talent to lose. 10 centuries have not produced 10 great men." So of the 3, he was the most moderate. Heine was even worse. Heine wrote, baptism was the entrance ticket to European culture. For the Jews, there is only one God, Mammon, money. And Rothschild is his prophet. And on and on. Marx, of course, was of the three, perhaps the worst in his anti-Semitism. He wrote a book actually called A World Without Jews. For Marx, the enemy of all progress was a Jew. The Jew was responsible for all the ills of the world. And I don't think Rabbi Wein makes this point, but the Marxian anti-Semitism became the basis, to some extent, for the Nazi philosophy, but to a very great extent, for the anti-Semitism in Stalinist Soviet Russia. This was one option. The Jew could turn completely away and just engage, embrace the Enlightenment 100%, and take it from there. And there are many, many Jews who did this. And this created a tremendous wave of assimilation that was probably unprecedented in Jewish history, Bechlau, but certainly was unprecedented in the 500 years that we're looking at. From the 1492 up until the early 1800s, in spite of all the tsars, and all the persecutions, and all the problems, you don't find a mass movement of assimilation. Forced conversion sometimes under the gun or under the threat of fire, but assimilation was even a word that really, there was a word for assimilation up until that time. And this time, assimilation becomes a real problem, especially northern France, central Europe, Germany, Austria. Assimilation becomes a tremendous problem, so much so that one of the most famous examples of this is the city of Frankfurt, which we'll look at again and again from this point on. The Rav of Frankfurt in the 1700s was the Hafla, the Hamakne, of Pinchas Horvitz, who was, as you know from the Svarim, tremendous Gadol Batorah. He also, by the way, was a Hasidic person. He wrote a Hasidic Svarim too, upon the Yafos. But he was the Rav of Frankfurt, and in his time, Frankfurt was still, late 1700s, a thriving Jewish community. Frankfurt was a major Jewish community for hundreds of years. By the time Shimshon Raphael Hirsch comes to Frankfurt, which is maybe half a century later, in the middle 1800s, Frankfurt is like, there's no one from left. I mean, you can barely scratch together a minion in a major city. In those 50 years, in the span of one generation, the accomplishment, if you can call it that, of assimilation was tremendous. Because so many Jews were taking this option of becoming Mishumadim, of just going away from Yahadus completely, any identification with it in any way or shape or form, let alone being from, just becoming not involved in their Jewishness. There was another option, and that's the option of reform. Reform Judaism. And it has to be seen historically in the light of the alternative assimilation. Because at least the initial early reform leaders weren't interested in assimilation per se. They were interested in somehow maintaining a Jewish identity. That's l'shivacham, if you can say that. However, Lignai, they wanted to reform Judaism to the extent that it would no longer be really recognizable as what we call Judaism today. So the Rewan writes, convinced that traditional Torah Judaism had no future in the modern world, and frightened by the conversion of so many Jews to Christianity, the leaders of Reform feverishly sought to accommodate an ancient faith to a swiftly changing society. So that in our survey of how the Jews cope with Enlightenment, we have to look at Reform as being a movement which tried to cope with Enlightenment in its way. Its way was to compromise Torah, to compromise Jewishness, to water it down so that there would be less and less and less of a contradiction between living as a Jew, a Reformed Jew, and the enlightened society around them. Here's some historical facts, just for the record. The first Reformed temple was dedicated in a city called Seesen, S-E-E-S-E-N, Germany, in 1810. Germany is, of course, the center of Reformed. That temple had an organ, a mixed choir, German sermons, German songs, German prayers, and ecclesiastical robes to the ritual. In other words, the rabbi, the chazan, wore the kind of robes that Christian ministers used to use. A Reformed temple opened in Berlin in 1815. The leader of this thrust of power by Reform is a man named Abraham Geiger, G-E-I-G-E-R. He is, if anyone is the father of the Reform movement, he was such. And it's interesting that he, earlier in his life,